about to let me tell you about the chicken grease. Stuff some things to make the people get out the seat. Everybody is good if you wanna clap your hands and move on your feet. Come on down to the front, but you can feel the beat. From the left to right to the back, to the middle and the front.
Welcome to Hot Grease. I am your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring satisfying tidbits of food culture. Our show hosts real conversations from everyday people navigating our food system and weekly chats with leaders in the world of sustainable food. Today, we'll be talking urban planning and the role of government in food access. The Nation magazine, Time magazine, New York Times magazine, and trade magazines such as American Planning Association in the past 3 months have covered the sustainable food movement as cover stories. In the studio, we have Allison Bea. Allison is an urban planner at New Yorkers for Parks, an open space advocacy organization in New York. Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So my thought is that most people are not clear about the responsibilities and various jobs of urban planners. What exactly is urban planning?
I think you're right. People have a variety of understandings, which is not necessarily bad. It's a broad discipline, looking at the way that cities are planned, the way that they morph and evolve through different eras of industrialization and then possibly decay and how they recover. And it's broken out into even smaller disciplines addressing housing, transportation, everything down to waste management. It can be.
So what are some of the traditional career paths of urban planning professionals?
Most urban planners, I think, go into one of three larger fields. One would be government work. Okay. There are departments of city planning in every city and town across America. In addition, they could work for a variety of other government agencies. Advocacy is a big one.
Okay.
There's a lot of policy involved in urban planning and making cities more easily livable. And then nonprofit and advocacy. So, and then academia, probably.
And what about some of the non-traditional career paths of urban planners?
Well, I think that in this day in New York, people are just sort of starting to consider a lot of things that weren't traditionally thought of as urban planning, like the sustainable food movement or food access, would be maybe a newer path for urban planners.
So you just talked about the intersection of urban planning and food access, particularly folks kind of going in that path. Is this a new concept, or has this the thought of food access always been in the world of urban planning?
It's not entirely new, but it's certainly gaining a lot of traction, and people are starting to really acknowledge that it is a pervasive problem, particularly in the inner city, where people don't have any access to fresh vegetables, dairy, fruits on a regular and easily accessible basis. It's too far away, it's often too expensive, and it's just not feasible to get to where they're selling those items.
Yeah, I think I read in getting ready for this show that the American Planning Association Board of Directors in 2007 adopted a policy guide on community and regional food planning recommendations. With the inclusion of food policy and local and regional plans. What exactly does that mean?
Well, there are a number of planning approaches to food access. I mean, obviously, the first concern with food access is a health concern.
Okay.
That people don't have healthy foods, and it contributes to obesity, diabetes, and all the other things that sort of follow from obesity. So there are a number of actions that a town or a region even could take to battle the food desert. One would be to change the zoning, because a major problem is that supermarkets, chains, do not view inner city, low-income areas as feasible places to open and to operate business. that is not true, but it is just a huge misconception, and that's what dominates the fact that they're not there. So you can incentivize them. You can change the zoning. New York City has just changed zoning in a number of neighborhoods that were proven to have to be food deserts to allow supermarkets to come in. You can, another planning approach is to provide new forms of transportation to healthy food spots. In New York, there's a bus service that goes to the Red Hook Pathmark.
That's right. I think I heard someone talking about that. They take seniors.
That's a different program, but yes, there are nationwide, there are more and more of these transportation programs getting people from in high density areas out to wherever the supermarket is.
So, speaking of communities and cities and stuff, the same Urban APA magazine article, actually, they had a write-up on Detroit. And Detroit has, 70,000 vacant lots and several initiatives, including converting these lots to community gardens. And I read people were converting them to pocket parks, active and passive parks. Is this plan in turning all of these vacant lots or a majority into community gardens, is this a long-term, is this a feasible solution, long-term solution to food access?
It depends on a couple of things. One thing is who actually owns that land, you know, whether or not that's in a trust that would expire at some point, or, you know, if it's a temporary solution. But if I don't know exactly what Detroit's park the legality is, but if it were New York, once it's converted to park space, it has a very good chance of being preserved in perpetuity to whatever use you want to use it. And I think the other thing that's important is that, you know, like Seattle is one of the most kind of forward thinking when it comes to community gardens, and they actually have legislation requiring the city to create 4 new community gardens every year going forward.
Yeah, I love what Seattle is doing. I think it was it in 2007? It's a few years ago. They actually, no, 2008, they adopted a resolution or a food charter. And I read that in there about that. And they had 4 or 5 very unique, maybe unique to me, but maybe not to you, things that they were doing in terms of policy and planning pieces. One of the things included the mid-sized grocery stores, changing the land use codes. This is very interesting about the Seattle Department of Transportation doing convenient pedestrian bike transportation connections between the community gardens, food banks, and food markets and farmers markets. What are your thoughts about Seattle's very unique and forward-thinking plans around food access?
Well, it's fantastic because they have, not only do they have a long-term plan that's very broad, it's quantifiable. They have these, you know, 4 new community gardens a year, and the other thing that's quantifiable is that they have a goal in legislation that says that for every 2,500 households, there should be 1 community garden, which is a great sort of just way through these ratios you can kind of establish quantifiable goals, and you can say, we're not meeting it in this neighborhood. Let's step up, you know, this neighborhood is what one that needs when it's not meeting that goal, whereas this neighborhood far surpasses it. So it's good to have quantifiable goals.
In the last few minutes of the segment, let's definitely talk New York, and let's talk New York's Planning Commission and food access. Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer came out with a report back in February called Food in the Public Interest. And then later, actually in September, the Department of Planning and the City Council approved a bill to offer zoning and tax incentives to develop full-service grocery stores, to devote space to fresh products and meats and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. What do you say at New York City, for New York City? Is New York City innovative?
We're at the, you know, we're in the forefront for sure. And this is great work. And I think the main thing to remember is that while people can choose what they eat, their choices are predetermined by what's available. So the more that you can provide, the demand is already there. It's just whether or not people can get to it. So, you know, Stringer has a list of goals that are really important, and the Department of City Planning is doing a great job with these new zoning incentives, and there's another set of financial incentives for the supermarket chains.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be coming back with Mark Winston Griffin. We'll be talking more about the role of government in food access. Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check out our program schedule and show archives on heritageradionetwork.com. Our second guest today is Mark Winston Griffin, a national recognized expert on community economic development. Mark writes for the Huffington Post, one of the most widely read progressive blog sites in the country, and is the founding community development page columnist at New York City's Gotham Gazette. Currently, Mark is a candidate for New York City's District 36 City Council seat in Central Brooklyn. Welcome to Hot Grease, Mark.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Nicole.
Mark, we were just talking about urban planning, defining urban planning, and food access here in New York around policy and policy here in New York, as well as other cities such as Detroit and Seattle. Please share your thoughts on the federal and local government and policymakers. Should they be playing a bigger role in food access?
Well, I think so. I mean, the question is, I think it's somewhat, well, I shouldn't say it's obvious, but I think for a lot of people who are concerned with food access and what I like to call food justice, believe that this is a time for sort of all hands on deck. So obviously, it's not like the government, whether it be local, state, or federal, has a sole responsibility, but certainly they should be playing a role in a partnership with private enterprise, with the nonprofit sector, with as many different actors who are concerned about these issues as possible.
Mark, you've identified bringing healthy and affordable food into the mainstream, food re-education, support of food of this food justice movement as solutions in Central Brooklyn. Please explain your thoughts and your position on each solution.
Well, I mean, I think of them as being part of a wider conversation about sustainability and about healthiness in areas like Central Brooklyn. A few years ago, I wrote a piece in the Gotham Gazette. Again, I used to maintain the community development page there. And I wrote about food justice, what I thought was sort of a growing movement in New York City. And, you know, I then went on to write an article for The Nation magazine. And ever since then, I've become more and more concerned about the fact that in neighborhoods that are low and moderate income, neighborhoods of color, that not only is there not ready access to healthy and affordable produce and foods in general in these kinds of neighborhoods, but the very culture itself, the conversation that's being had in these neighborhoods, is not one of how do we create more ready access to these kinds of to supermarkets and things like food co-ops and building CSAs and having green markets and all these kinds of things that I think really bring together people around a broader conversation about how do we make ourselves healthy through food? How do we build institutions that are owned and operated by local people that fulfill the mission of not only giving access to local healthy food, but also help to re-educate the neighborhood,
right,
and give local people a stake in these kinds of issues.
So, Mark, I mean, when you look at other urban cities, some of the projects and programs that you see around the country, what model do you see as a great model for improving Central Brooklyn's food system?
Well, I mean, I think that you see a lot of sort of disparate kinds of things here and there. I mean, I don't know of many cities, and I can't say that I'm deeply well-versed in what they're doing across the country, but I don't know of many cities that have thought very comprehensively about these kinds of issues. I know here in New York, you see things like the Healthy Bodega Program, which is trying to bring produce into bodegas. You see that they're trying to make sure that low and moderate income neighborhoods have access to the food that's presented at green markets. You have this sort of fight against trans fats in restaurants, and you know, sort of requirement for fast food joints to show how many calories their foods have. So I think that there are a lot of different things. I just don't think that, you know, there's been one. I just don't think that there's a kind of comprehensive and concerted look to see how do we develop things again in a much more coordinated and integrated fashion. So, for instance, if I was to become the next city councilperson for 36th District, one of the things I would do, hopefully as chair of the Community Development Committee, would be to have a series of hearings that would talk about what are some of the best, not only what are some of the best models across the country, but how can we practically and affordably bring them to bear here in New York City, so that we're taking a structural approach, not just sort of a project here, a project there, but something that kind of is very thoughtful and, again, is as comprehensive as possible.
So, Mark, if listeners wanted to learn more about your candidacy for District 36 and your positions on food access and other very pertinent issues, how can we get in contact with you?
Well, you can either go to our website, M.W. Griffith, that's MWGRIFFITH.com. You can go there. It provides a wealth of information. As well, you can call us at 718-953-1110. And you can talk to someone right here at the campaign office. And, you know, we could get you started there. But, again, it is part of a larger conversation about sustainability, about healthiness, about environmental justice and greening our neighborhoods, that it's a conversation I'm really anxious to have with anyone.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Hot Greased and definitely providing your expertise on food access and policymakers. We look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thank you, Nicole. You have a great day.
You too. After a short break, we'll be back with the Hot Five. Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. This program is sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Let me give a Southern Girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. The location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. To wrap up today's show, Allison Bea is still in the studio. She's a native of North Carolina and always on the lookout for good homegrown food and a way to get her hands in some dirt. Allison is going to be giving us the Hot Five. I'm hot. The Hot Five is a rundown of five things on fire in the good food movement. Influencers, farmers, celebrities, business owners, and chefs dish on their favorites. So, Allison, I think you're going to be doing the Hot Five on what? Sustainable projects?
Urban planning, food access.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So hit us with number five.
Number five is Social Compact. It's a nonprofit research group that provides up-to-date, in-depth research on urban communities that are rapidly changing geographies, and they're often overlooked by supermarket chains. And they use their drill-down research to really get after the real purchasing power of those neighborhoods.
What do you mean by drill down?
That's what they call their research. They drill down into the community to get after like the hidden populations that are there that would be purchasing.
So what, give me an example of one of the cities. Is it like small town or do they do large cities or?
They've done a lot. I mean, Louisville, Kentucky is one of them.
Okay.
You know, and it's sort of portions of the town, you know, the town that is in need and can't really prove that they've got the purchasing power because the census data is incomplete.
Gotcha.
All right. So I like them. They're a great research group.
Number four, Hot Five list.
Number four is a great spot here in New York, Queens County Farm. In Queens. It's a 47-acre working farm in New York City, and they have tours and educational programs. They have live animals out there, and they sell their produce in Union Square Market.
Actually, I think someone from Queens Farm did a fundraiser for Mark Winston Griffith last Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so number four, on to number three.
Number three is one of my favorite organizations based out of New York, Project for Public Spaces. It's a nonprofit urban planning and design organization. They're after improving all public spaces, including markets, farmers markets. And one of my favorite projects they've recently done is they've funded the Southland Farmers Market Association in L.A. And this Farmers Market Association, through this funding, is selling and giving away fruits and vegetables in public schools.
So they're a New York-based organization, but they do work outside of New York?
Nationwide and internationally. They do a lot of workshops on how to build markets and create successful markets in public spaces.
Okay. So we're down to number two.
Number two is my favorite urban planning magazine, Next American City. It's a quarterly about how all great success stories from across the country and how urban planners are making cities better and easier to live in.
So do they have a website?
They have a great website.
And so I know these like APA magazines and these quarterly magazines, they're kind of expensive, like $10, $12.
All the content is on this website.
Oh, great. Actually,
I think it's $25 or something around there for the year.
Okay.
It is expensive, but it's a cool magazine with great design.
So is it a trade magazine or is it for the general public?
It's ideas and culture and, I mean, it's urban planning ideas, but it's more than that. I mean, I have friends who have subscriptions to it and they're not urban planners.
Tell me the name one more time.
Next American City.
Gotcha. So we're down to number one on the Hot Five list.
Number one is my new favorite recipe website, cookthink.com. And they have thousands of recipes, and you can search by your mood and your craving.
So give me an example of how you use CookThink recently.
Well, over the weekend, it was cold out, and I was tired, and I searched by warmth comfort, butter, garlic, and you can kind of mix your mood with ingredients even, seasons. You can mix them all together.
Do they have any other elements besides mood that you can put in to come up with a recipe or search for a recipe?
Yeah, you can. It's all the traditional ones as well. You can search by cuisine, season, any ingredient. Sure.
Is it owned by a huge conglomerate or is it just an indie website?
It is not. It's a couple of young people out of Washington, D.C.
Cool. So we have the Hot Five. Thank you, Allison, for coming into Hot Grease today and giving us the Hot Five. The next few shows, I'm going to give you a highlight of what we'll have. We'll have great food writer, former writer for Cookie Magazine blog. She'll be in the studio next Monday. Starting in November, we're going to go high gear into Thanksgiving and the holiday season. So we'll have one of our first guests on Hot Grease. Stacey West will be coming back with Modern Social Etiquette at the Holidays. And a great upstate young farmer coming in and talking about Thanksgiving meals and turkeys and great recipes. So continue to listen to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you again for listening to Hot Grease. Join me every Monday at 3:30 on Heritage Radio Network. Until then, always take the road less traveled. My own beliefs are